This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
Listening to the DGP with province writer Dana G.
Hi, welcome to the DGP podcast with me, Dana G. So it's summertime, and for a lot of people, that means one thing and one thing only. Sunscreen? No, it means reading books. Everybody talks about good summer reads. So today, I have a conversation with an author who's supplied a lot of good reads over the years. What we're going to talk about today, his most recent book. Carl Safina has written Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Now, Safina is one of these guys that is always looking at different ways to look at animals, to, I don't know, communicate with them is not the right word, but to understand them more. He's written quite a few books. He's won every single award going. So what this book does is it looks at the cognitive process that animals go through. Like, what do they feel? What are they thinking? Things like that. So what happens in this one is Safina takes the reader into the minds and behaviors of elephants, wolves, and dolphins. He travels around the world and with scientists and visit these things. An interesting part for us, those of us here on the West Coast, is one of the parts in the book, at the very the last part of the book, actually, he is in Harrow Strait, which isn't far here from Vancouver, studying dolphins, which we all know here on the West Coast, the big dolphins, the killer whales. So that's a great, got a great little sort of a local angle for us. You know, what I really liked about this book is, though, it's a science book. It's a book about animals, but it's also really, really readable. It's an interesting sort of almost a travelogue. And he makes the sort of the conversation about the growing field of understanding animal cognition a kind of interesting, beautiful sort of dialogue, which I guess makes sense if you're looking at how animals communicate. So I love this book, so we should really check it out. So let's just wade right in, and here's my conversation with Carl Safina. Well, hi, Carl. Thanks for joining us this morning on the podcast. Fascinating book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Let's just start with that right there, what animals think and feel. Tell me about heading towards this topic or this way of looking at animals and what made you want to do this.
Well, I've looked at animals for my entire life in different ways. I've had pets. I used to raise homing pigeons. I used to train hawks. I've had the usual dogs and cats. And then I spent a lot of time watching wild animals. And I often hear people say that you can't know anything about whether they can think or whether they can feel, and that just seemed kind of absurd. I think most people understand that they can think and feel, but they don't really know how to look at it or how to think about it or how much they might be able to think and feel. So I wanted to get into that topic. Another thing is that I've worked in conservation a long time, mostly ocean conservation. And we always talk about conservation by the numbers. We say this species is down by 80%. They've lost 75% of their habitat. There are only 4,000 of them left. And those are just numbers. And that might be what we're losing, but I also wanted to show who is at stake and show how they value their lives and how hard they try to stay alive and keep their children alive, just like we do.
At the very beginning of the book, you talk about how scientists, the way they've approached things and looks at things, and how who are these animals is sort of a forbidden part in science, is to really to understand who they are.
Yes, because when people first started to try to develop a science of animal behavior in about the 1950s, you had real giants like Conrad Lorenz and Nico Tinbergen, people like that. And they needed to start with a clean slate. So they said, look, we're not going to assume anything. They had to wipe away centuries of fables about animals like foxes are clever and grasshoppers are lazy. They had to make it a science. So they said, okay, we're going to start with nothing. Just assume nothing at all. And we can't see into their minds, but we can see what they're doing, so we're only going to talk about what they're doing. And that made a lot of sense. But not assuming anything is different than assuming that there's nothing going on in their mind. And then what happened was when the luminaries and the geniuses retired and died, they were replaced by people who said, well, the luminaries and geniuses say we can't know what's in their minds, so this is a topic that we will not look at. And then that became, this is a topic that is off limits. Mm. And in the professional world, it was just kind of unbelievable how even raising the question of what do you think that animal is thinking would get a horrible reaction from people. You know, you couldn't publish anything about that. But in the 60 years or so since those people started to develop a science, a couple of new things happened that had never happened before. One is that people actually started watching the lives of wild animals in a systematic and scientific way. They had none of that to go on. And the other is that we know a lot more about brains and minds than we did 60 years ago. Almost all of brain science and psychology or experimental psychology has happened since then. So we now have a lot to go on.
Right. I've one thing that in the book that I kept sort of, I don't know, having to remind myself of or go back to is to not think of animals like we think of ourselves. You know, we've all done that over the years, you know, the characteristics. Oh, that's like, and to really step aside. And I think that comes so clear with the elephants. You know, I just think that is that going to be a big thing for people to get rid of that idea that, you know, they, not even the anthropomorphizing of them, but, you know, thinking them like we are.
Well, that is a double-edged sword because you shouldn't assume that they're just like us and that everything that they mm-hmm. do is what you would do if you were them, because they're not you. And instead of asking how are they like us, which of course puts all the emphasis back on us, which is our favorite story, is us, the better question is how are they, like us or not? And that's how you learn about them. However, the other side of that is that if you're really looking at them and if you're really thinking about them and what they're doing and how to make sense of that, then thinking about what it is that they're doing in our terms, in human terms, is helpful because their minds are a lot like ours. Their brains are very, very much like ours. I'm talking about mammals particularly. I mean, we have a mammalian brain and we have a human addition to that. And they have mammalian brains too. So a lot of the brain chemicals are the same. A lot of the brain structures that create emotions and motivations are the same. So if you say, you know, that animal seems to be just relaxing, the animal is relaxing. And if they seem to be happy and they're playing, they are happy and playing. It's not, you can't exactly know what they're thinking, but I can't exactly know what you're thinking either. Mm-hmm. I try to tell what you're thinking in the logic of your actions. So if you see, for instance, if you see young elephants that are lying on the ground and adults are around them standing up and everybody seems relaxed and everybody is kind of snoozing, well, that is what they're doing. They're not terrified. They're not eating. They're doing something that makes sense to you because you use your human experience to say they look like they're relaxing and they look like they're letting the baby sleep, but the adults are sort of, you know, maintaining a little bit of vigilance just in case. And that is exactly right. So we can make sense of what they're doing and we can apply logic and we can apply the evidence. And evidence and logic is what we call science. So that's not a bad thing to do. You just have to be careful about overdoing it. For instance, if you see a male and a female elephant and you say, oh, look, they're in love. Well, if you know about elephants, you would know that elephants do not fall in love in a romantic sense because they don't have any pair bonds between the males and the females. They mate. The male goes off. The female goes back to her family. The family of females is the main unit with elephants. And there's no bond. There's no male parental care. So, no, they're not in love. But we don't make that mistake when we know a little bit about elephants. So you have to watch them and know something about them. And then some anthropomorphizing or saying, you know, I can make sense of that. In human terms, this is what I would be doing, or that's what they seem to be doing. That is a way of understanding, because we have passions. You know, we defend the things that are ours. We are jealous about the losing the things that are ours. We know who our friends are. We know who our rivals are. We have ambitions for higher status. And many animals have all of those things.
When you're with the elephants, an interesting part of that is you start to see in them as well, is that figuring that they were figuring out where the humans stood within the other humans. You know, when they felt threatened or something, that they were sort of going and telling off the boss. Like, they were able to figure out the social hierarchy on our side, which I thought that was quite fascinating, that they, you know, they're looking at the people looking at them just as much.
That's another thing that dolphins do, is that they know the people, too. They don't just know who they are among themselves, but they know who they are and who the people are among the people, and talking about people who are familiar to them. So dolphins may want to get the attention of their young one. If a young one is playing with a human, and this is some researchers in the Bahamas, led by a woman named Denise Herzing. If a young one is playing with one of the researchers and the young one's mother wants to leave and wants the young one's attention, she may actually go to Dr. Herzing and direct a tail slap at her, saying, can you get control of your human, because I need to get control of my baby and I want to leave. Another thing with elephants is they can distinguish between kinds of people who threaten them and kinds of people who don't, just by their sounds and by their sense. So researchers took speakers and played the recorded voices of farmers who don't bother the elephants and tourists who don't bother the elephants and herders who sometimes do bother the elephants and occasionally hurt them. And the elephants could tell the voices and the languages apart. They knew the farmers. They didn't respond to that. And now I'm talking about recorded voices, so there's no scent involved. Mm-hmm. And they're coming out of the same speaker in the same place. And then when they played the tourist voices, no response. They don't need to care. Then when they played the voices of the Maasai herders, the elephants got alarmed, fled, bunched up, started to sniff the air with their trunks, trying to figure out where these people might be. And they have the same way of differentiating if you leave the clothing of those people in the path of a group of elephants. So you leave a T-shirt that's been worn by a tourist, they don't care. T-shirt that's been worn by a herder, a Maasai herder, they're afraid of it. So that's pretty incredible and pretty surprising. And 50 years ago, no one had any idea that these animals' minds were capable of that kind of differentiation and that they knew what was going on so well.
Yeah, that's interesting. Carl, how did you decide on the locations for this book? You're in Kenya with the elephants. You go to Yellowstone National Park with free-living wolves. And then we'll talk a little bit about you're close to us here in the Harrow Strait with the orcas. So tell me, how did you decide to pick and where you were going to go and what you were going to look at?
Well, first I wanted to look at several animals whose social lives include structured groups. And what I mean by structured is, if you think of a herd of wildebeest or zebras, nobody is really the leader of the herd. Everybody is pretty much equal. And I was trying to find out who are the animals that have structured groups where there's a leader and there are followers, and leaders change over time. They either depose one another, or they simply age into higher status, like elephants do. Elephant status is related to how old they are because of how much they know, and the family knows to follow the older ones because they have the wisdom and the knowledge to help keep everybody alive. So there's not that many different animals that live in structured social groups that are well studied. And I wanted to pick three, so I picked three that were kind of different. One giant herbivore, the elephants. One carnivore, that is a pretty well-known animal to people, at least by name, even if they don't know really a lot about wolves. and then one in the ocean, and that was the orcas or the killer whales.
Yeah, well, obviously being here in Vancouver, reading that part of the book is exciting to know that somewhere nearby that you were watching these amazing animals. But how much I learned, you know, the different types. I knew there were a few different types of killer whales. I didn't realize, I think you outlined there's eight of them.
I would say there's probably eight, yes.
Yeah.
And they haven't been separately named scientifically in the formal literature. They don't have formal Latin names, but the researchers refer to them differently. In the Pacific Northwest, there are three. There are the transients, the residents, and the offshores. And in the Antarctic, there are about four or five, and they refer to them by numbers down there. They call them type A, type B, and that kind of thing.
They're kind of hiding in plain sight in a way, aren't they?
They're absolutely hiding in plain sight, because these are different species that have not bred with one another for millions of years, but they look very similar, and so people have always thought that they are one species, and it's very strange. I mean, people don't quite understand everything that's going on with them, but they don't breed, they don't socialize or mingle or mix in any way. They eat completely different things. The mammal hunters of the Northwest do not eat fish, and the fish eaters do not eat mammals. And so they're really different creatures, but they look very similar. And that's why people didn't realize that they were hiding in plain sight.
Well, and they don't do anything the same, but they, you know, swim right past each other. I mean, the transient and resident stuff was fascinating. You know, that the transients are almost silent all the time.
Right.
What I learned in this, too, is the way that they share their food. I never even thought about that before. I thought, okay, killer whale gets a seal, he eats the seal.
Yeah.
That they share it amongst themselves.
They share most of the time, almost all the time, yeah. And it turns out that very, very few other animals actually share.
Mm-hmm.
They might, you know, monkeys might all sit in the same fruit tree, but they're not going to pick a fruit and bring it to somebody and say, here, have half of my mango. They don't do that. It's very, very rare in the living world to have animals that actually bring food to another animal, even a family member. So there are birds that do that with their nestlings, of course. That's one thing they do. That's feeding babies. I'm talking about sharing either an adult child or somebody who is not your young one, like, you know, maybe a family member or somebody that you're not related to. That is extremely, extremely rare. Chimpanzees do a little bit of it. Wolves do it with their families. They will bring back, you know, meat mostly to feed the pups. And killer whales share a lot with their family members.
Well, how is climate change, how is that affecting the killer whales? Are they moving? Are they migrating further? What are we seeing?
Well, so many things are keyed into the climate in so many ways that climate change affects things in hundreds of different ways. One thing that's happening in the ocean is that the areas of plankton abundance are moving and the areas of fish abundance are moving. And the productivity of the ocean is changing. So all of those things affect everything that lives there. And climate change will probably begin to affect the productivity of salmon from the southern end of their range as it gets too warm for them. Probably the same thing with other marine mammals like seals and the food base for the seals. All those things are in motion and changing right now. And you can see it where you look. So people who look at ice see melting ice. People who look at where fish spend the winter see that they're spending the winter farther north. I know somebody rather well who studies that off the east coast of the United States, the center of winter abundance of fish. And it's very surprising to me. But then you think about it for a minute and you say, well, it's not too surprising. They are responding.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend who fished lobsters commercially for 25 years, and in 1 2-week period, all the lobsters in Long Island Sound died because it got just a little too warm for them.
Wow, yeah.
And they've never come back. And that friend who was a commercial fisherman for 30 years, he is now a nurse.
Wow. Wait, this is your seventh book, is that correct?
That is correct.
So what keeps you coming back to this and wanting to tell us more about it? What excites you?
Well, first of all, life is very exciting, and it's endlessly interesting. And I absolutely love the animals. They really make the world a rich, rich place. Right now, while I'm talking to you, I'm just looking out the window kind of idly, and there are birds flying by. And, you know, these things make the world beautiful and interesting. And in addition to being part of the, you know, just the overall diversity that makes the world an interesting place, they help explain things about ourselves that we wouldn't really be able to realize if we didn't understand our place in the whole scheme of things. So there's way, way, way more than anybody could begin to tackle in a lifetime of writing. And a lot is at stake because we don't really know who these creatures are, and yet all of them are really, really feeling us. I went to look at three of the most protected populations of these animals anywhere in the world: elephants in national parks in Kenya, wolves in Yellowstone National Park, and the orcas of the Pacific Northwest. And I went there because I wanted to see what they do when people are not affecting them. And what I found was that people affect them everywhere. Mm. In Kenya, the elephants are all under this tremendous violence of the ivory poaching. And every family of elephants is affected by that. They live in fear. Most of them have had family members killed. They are afraid to move outside the parks, but they can't stay inside the parks only. The parks are too small for everything that elephants need to do. Same thing in Yellowstone. The park is too small for a population of wolves to spend their whole lives there. So most of them leave at some points. Many of them get killed. In the Pacific Northwest, the orcas are having trouble finding fish as the salmon have declined, especially the king salmon that many of the residents mainly mm-hmm. focus on hunting. They have problems with toxic chemicals. They have problems with military testing where live bombs are exploded that in some cases blow their ears out and they've been killed that way. So these are the most protected populations in their refuges, and it doesn't really make the whole difference. So a lot is at stake, and that's part of why I'm trying to introduce who these animals really are.
I think it's a good tack from reading through the book. I mean, I was at a dinner party the other night, and I pulled three or four things out of your book and got people talking about it. So I'm wondering for you, when you went in and went to these locations and spent time with these animals, if you could tell me from each one something that really surprised you, that you go to first when somebody sort of would ask you about the book or tell them something.
Well, the most incredible thing about the elephants is that they really are incredibly gentle with one another, and they are incredibly caring with everybody in their families. The family is led by the matriarch, the older female. All the other ones with her are her adult daughters and their offspring, and then the juvenile males leave, and they go with male groups or just sort of wander around. But those families are very, very cohesive. They really keep an eye on each other. They really know what they're doing. They're just a gigantic, peaceful presence. And it's unbelievable how quickly you just fall in love with them and cannot imagine an earth without elephants in the span of a few days, really. And I spent about a month there. Then in Yellowstone with the wolves, I knew that a wolf pack was just a family with two breeders and their young ones from 2 or 3 years. That is the pack. But what I didn't know was all the politics involved and all of the ambition and the vendettas with other packs and all the strategies that they employ in hunting and in trying to maneuver around and with rival packs. There's a huge soap opera going on in the lives of wolves all the time. And they're extremely smart. And with the killer whales, Talk about extremely smart. I mean, a brain that size needs something to do, and they are astonishingly perceptive. Not just smart, but just astonishingly perceptive. And then with them again, the really incredible thing is that no free-living killer whale has ever hurt a person. Mm-hmm. They kill big things for a living, including marine mammals, and yet they have never overturned a kayak. There was an orphan that lived way up a fjord in British Columbia for 6 years, an orphan named Luna.
Oh, we know that one well here.
When Luna wanted to play with a 40-foot sailboat, he'd give it a shove. But when he wanted to play with two women in a kayak, he would give it a tiny little gentle tap. Now, how does a juvenile killer whale seem to understand that if those women wound up in the water, it would be bad for them and be so careful not to hurt them? I mean, that's just incredible for a giant predator to be that perceptive and that gentle with human beings. Why in the world? It defies explanation. And even though I am a scientist, and I think that we understand, I think we appreciate things a lot more when we understand them. I'm not one of these mystics, but the mysteries around the minds and the thought processes of all of these animals, and especially really the killer whales, really, really got me. The mystery around them is just astonishing.
So a bit of advice for those of us that are here and live in their midst. I mean, we just had a group of killer whales come right into Vancouver. I think it was last week. Mm-hmm. We see them off the ferries if you're going down. What do you want people to think if they see one swimming next to the boat they're in, to think or maybe always take away when they see those animals?
Well, I think you should understand who they are. You know, if one of the researchers saw them, let me just say, if we see them, we tend to say, oh, look, there's some killer whales. And, you know, that's like saying, oh, look, there's some people. But there are a lot of people who know exactly who those people are, and those people know exactly who they are. And it's exactly the same with the killer whales. If you went with the researchers, they wouldn't just say, oh, look, there's some killer whales. They would say, oh, that looks like that's half the L pod, and that's L26 and L41, and she's 42 years old right now, and she just had her last calf 3 years ago. They know these whales because they are individuals. So the more you learn about them, and there is plenty of information around that right now. There's my book. There's Eric Hoyt's book. There's a book by Ken Balcom and Pat Ford, those guys. There's a lot there, and the more you know, the more you can appreciate who you are there with and who's there with you.
Right. So, Carl, your book is the one we're recommending for people to read for summer reading this that time of year. I'm wondering, what's your summer reading look like?
Well, it's funny. I'm trying desperately to get into a couple of novels. I don't read novels too much, but I'm trying desperately to get into The Goldfinch. Mm-hmm. I've been rereading some Peter Matheson work. He was a guy who was a hero of mine, and I got to know him later in his life, and he passed away about a year ago. So I'm sort of keeping him close by reading a couple of his books. I have H's for Hawk on my night table, and trying to plow through as much reading this summer as I possibly can, even though I'm pretty distracted with the launch of my own book as well. It's a lot going on with that. So that's great.
What do you have at home for pets or animals that you live with?
We have two dogs from the dog pound. One is a retriever mix and one is a border collie mix. And I never was much of a dog person until about 5 years ago. I cannot believe how much I love these dogs and how much they are really part of the family. We have two parrots. We have three chickens. We have a snake. And we have a squirrel that we found as a little orphan baby. We bottle raised it. And it lives in the woods behind our house and comes most days to get some treats from us and is still completely tame but completely free living.
Then if they only knew who was giving them the treats. You have to have a conversation with them about that at some point. Carl, thank you so much for chatting with us today. It's fascinating. The book is absolutely fascinating. I'm passing it on. Like I said, I've been pulling from it for our dinner party conversation. So thanks for that.
Well, thank you for that. That's really like best case for any author. And I really appreciate the interest, and the discussion has been really a lot of fun. So thank you so much.
All right, Carl, you have a great day. Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.
Waiting for the summertime, longing for the blossoms on the trees, oh, to feel that soft, refreshing breeze in the summertime. Waiting.
So that was my chat with Carl Safina. You know, go get his book. It's called Beyond Words, What Animals Think. Like I said, it's a fascinating, entertaining read. I really learned a lot from it. And the best part is I got a ton of great bits of information out that I could use at dinner parties. So I looked really clever for a few weeks after reading that book, Adam. Anyway, it did come in handy. It's always good to have other things to talk about than reality television and Donald Trump, I think. So, yeah, so check out that book again, Beyond Words, What Animals Think. I highly recommend it. Also, I should mention, once again, there's no movie reviews this week because of summer holidays, and we taped some of these episodes in advance. Adam's moaning because Adam likes the movie reviews. He loves them. And also, heads up, because it is the summertime, and this is airing on August 21st, there's going to be a couple of weeks that there's no DGP.
Because what?
Well, I need to take some time off, Adam. I need to work on my holistic self. I need to find my chakras and align them. And then I'm going to find wine and apply to my chakras. Like, calm down my chakras. Anyways, enough about me. But before I go off into the warm West Coast world, I'd like to thank, of course, Adam Foster. Yay! That's our clap machine. Yeah. And also, my guest today was Carl Safina. You can check out other DGP episodes at theprovince.com/podcast or on Stitcher, iTunes, and TuneIn. And if you want to see some fine Periscope action, you need to go and check us out there at Province Podcast. Alrighty, thanks for listening and enjoy the last remaining days of summer. Woohoo! I don't know why I woohooed that.
You've been listening to the DGP, hosted by province writer Dana G. Follow Dana on Twitter at Dana_G or read her stories on theprovince.com. Subscribe to this and other great province podcasts by searching iTunes or clicking the links available on theprovincepodcasts.com.